Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, this is Pankaj Jain, a host on the New Books Network. And today we'll be talking to Professor Jeffrey Long about his 2009 book, Jainism, An Introduction, originally published by IB Taurus and now being marketed by Bloomsbury Press. Hello, Jeff Bhai, Professor Jeffrey Long, my longtime colleague and friend. We met, I think, almost 20 years back at a conference in Florida. And now here we are after almost two decades and we are together and still on the same journey, although yes, physically apart, but on the same journey. How are you? Namaste.
Doing very well. It's wonderful to be here today. Thank you for inviting me to have this conversation.
Thank you. And congratulations on your new home in Pennsylvania. And
thank you.
We have a great background picture of Ramakrishna Paramhans also, as always. But today we are going to specifically discuss about your Jainism book. I think one of first of its kind that came by a Western scholar living in America on Jainism, right? Which introduces Jainism to general public, undergraduate students, or even graduate students. So I guess, first of all, so this is a book that came in 2009 called Jainism, An Introduction by, what was the publisher again? Sorry, the name of IB Taurus.
IB Taurus, I think it's now being distributed by Bloomsbury.
Oh, Bloomsbury also, all right, great. So. To begin with, I guess I would like to ask, I think most of the scholars in America or even in Europe, I think they are mostly interested more in Hinduism and Buddhism. Jainism is relatively less known entity, even in India and also in the West. So how did you get this idea to get into Jainism, and why this book?
Well, that's a wonderful question. And as you said, like many scholars, my interests also were primarily in Hinduism and Buddhism. I became interested especially in Hindu traditions from an early age. I am now part of the tradition of Sri Ramakrishna. That's why his picture is here.
Yes.
Part of what in America we call the Vedanta Society. In India, they call it Ramakrishna Mission. And my advisor in graduate school, Paul J. Griffiths, was a scholar of Buddhism. So I did a lot of coursework in Buddhism. So how I got interested in Jainism, it's an interesting story. It's a little bit roundabout. But one idea that has been very interesting to me and very central to my work all through from the beginning, my work on Hinduism as well as in Jainism, is the idea of what in the Vedanta tradition they call dharma samanvaya, or harmony of religions. Yeah. The idea that there's not just one true religion. See, I grew up in Missouri, a fairly conservatively Christian area, and there were a lot of people who believed you had to be Christian. If you weren't Christian, you were going to hell. You were damned forever. In fact, not just Christian, you had to be the right kind of Christian. I grew up Catholic, and that was not the right kind of Christian for many of these people. So you're going to hell. And this whole idea that a benevolent God would create billions and billions of life forms and send all of them to hell except the handful that were part of this one church, it never made sense to me. I just thought that was not only did it not make sense, but I thought it was a destructive idea. You know, it's been used to justify imperialism and colonialism and all, you know, very, very problematic, and all of the things that have flown out, you know, flown from that. So when I started getting interested in Indian religions, My first point of entry actually was Mahatma Gandhi, and I remember being really, really struck by a quote of his where he said, religions are many paths to the same goal. It doesn't matter what path you take so long as you reach the goal. And I thought that made much more sense. I found that really drew me. But as I explored this idea more deeply and getting into graduate school and so on, I found there were many philosophers who were trying to articulate this idea, but it's difficult sometimes to persuade people philosophically about this. Like on a sort of heart level, people say, oh yeah, that's great. Let everyone be included. Everyone should be, all paths should be respected and so on. The religions aren't all the same. They teach very different things, right? Christianity says there is a creator God. Jainism says no creator God, right? Buddhism says creator God. So how do we make sense of saying there are many paths and yet they are somehow fitting together into this larger harmony? And so as I studied Indian philosophy in Chicago, as I was at University of Chicago, and I began really delving deeply. Most of my reading had been, sort of more popular books, the autobiography of a yogi and, that sort of thing. So this was not really, I'm getting into hardcore philosophy. And I read a book by the late Bimal Krishna Motilal called Language and Reality. And it's very in-depth, talks about Nyaya philosophy. And he has a wonderful section on Jainism, and he talked about this idea of anekantavada, that reality is multifaceted, and syadvada, that you have to analyze a truth claim in terms of the perspective from which it's made. And there, all truth claims can have some truth and some falsehood. And in that way, you could kind of create a harmonizing view, which is what a lot of the Jain philosophers do. They pull together, Buddhism teaches impermanence, Vedanta teaches one unchanging reality. How do you bring them together? Well, there are ways of sort of showing logically that, if you're talking about the phenomenal level of reality, it's very much like Buddhism describes. If you're talking about ultimate reality, you get into a more Vedantic direction. So Jain philosophy had this very nice integrating pluralistic philosophy. So I made that the topic of my dissertation. And I found another wonderful book by Motilal that's just specifically on this. It's called, so it's a thin little book, but it's very profound. It's called Anekantavada, the Central Philosophy of Jainism. I found it when I was in India, in fact. I was living in India and for 2 years, and I found that book. I said, this is what I want to do. So I wrote my dissertation on that. And in my first book, which is really sort of developing from kind of a Hindu perspective of this pluralistic philosophy, there is a chapter where I drew a lot from Jain thought, right? What I'd been studying in my dissertation. And so my editor at IB Taurus at the time, Alex Wright, I think he works for Cambridge now. He said, you also study Jain philosophy. There's not really that easily accessible of a book on Jainism for, say, undergraduates. Why don't you write one? And first, I was really daunted by that because I'd been studying the philosophy, not much anthropology, right? I wasn't, when I was in India, I wasn't, sort of going and spending time with, Jain Munis or much time. Since then, I've spent a lot of time with the Jain community and I feel very comfortable in the Jain community, but I knew very little about practice. So I had to do a lot of research to write the book. But I accepted because I thought it was important for people to understand the tradition. There was a wonderful book, The Jaina Path of Purification by Padmanabh Jaini, who recently
passed away. Yes.
Very huge loss. I tell people he was in his 90s, but he went too soon because he's such a wonderful thing. And really, I was, and I met him a couple of times. I was very honored to know that his book was the only one available for many, many years. You wanted to learn about Jainism. And it's a fantastic book. At the same time, scholarship is always developing. So by the time my book came out, his was about 30 years old, right? So, it was time for another book. And so I published mine, but that's the story, right? My entry point to the study of Jainism was Anekantavad, Syadvad. And then that led to getting more engaged with the whole tradition. And really, and I'm so glad that I did because it is so much to offer. And as you say, it's understudied, but I think it's every bit as important as the two other main Dharma traditions, right? Hindu and Buddhist. The Jain tradition is a very important part of.
Right. Yeah, great. So that gives me good entry point into deeper into your book. So How do you think your book charts a path that is sort of, that is different from what Professor Padmanabh Jaini did in his book, in his path-breaking book called The Jaina Path of Purification, and the other book, that other major book that we didn't mention so far, The Jains by Professor Paul Dundas in the UK.
Yes.
So how did you chart out your path, which is sort of maybe complementary to these two major books that came before?
That's right. And you have these two excellent books. And of course, the first thing you ask yourself is, why do we need another book, right? It is Jaini's book. Paul Dundas wrote this wonderful book called The Jains. But again, I think part of the answer, in fact, even if you look at Paul Dundas' book, The Jains, it kind of gives you part of the answer to the question. He himself wrote a second edition of that book. First published, I think, in 1992, and then he did another one in 2002. Just because our knowledge keeps developing, especially in the field of Jain studies, because there are even many Jain texts that either have not been translated into Western languages, or the last time they were was over 100 years ago. The English itself has changed. So you read those old translations, and the English itself is incomprehensible sometimes. You know, it's like, well, this isn't how we talk anymore. So and the other thing that I found was, and again, I think Professor Jaini and Professor Dundas' books are fantastic. I recommend them highly all the time. I will say that for what I have found with my undergraduate students, I teach mainly undergrads, and they're extremely bright, they're extremely curious, but they have no background. And both Professor Jaini's book, I think anyone can pick that up and get a good understanding of Jainism, but it helps if you already know some Indian philosophy. A lot of terminology, a lot of things that'll be unfamiliar to someone who's new to it. That's probably true of my book as well, but I tried to make it as clear as and comprehensible to someone who had no background. And Professor Dundas' book is also very, very clear, but it's massive. I mean, he talked about everything, the whole history of Jainism, philosophy and practice. So it could be daunting, I think, to an undergraduate or to someone who's just saying, oh, what's Jainism? So I would feel comfortable assigning, and I do assign their books in upper level undergraduate courses where they've already done a course, or graduate school. But I want to write something someone who knew nothing could pick up and get an idea.
I would completely agree with that. I've read all three books, of course, maybe more than one times. And yours is really like, you know, good, you know, tantalizing appetizer. you wet your feet, and then you dive into the major books by Professor Jaini and Professor Dundas. And then you get overwhelmed with so much information from so many technical terms in Professor Jaini's book, especially, and technical details, historical details, archaeological details in Professor Dundas' book. So all three of the books, I think, are great complement to each other, I think. So
if it's in that company, then I'm extremely grateful.
Yes, of course.
Because I was, like I said, I was nervous about it. It had not, the part I had really studied for years was the philosophy. So you know, I was venturing into, for me, fairly new territory with some of the chapters. But I learned so much. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about writing and teaching. We're learning new things all the time.
Yes. Right. And so let's take a look chapter by chapter. Right. Okay. So in the introduction, how have you introduced Jainism, or how would you maybe, you know, if you were to go for a second edition of your book, how would you introduce Jainism, or what's the best way to, for a beginner to, you know, how we make it relevant for a student who is in America or in UK or in Europe? You know, how do we make him or her relevant, Jainism relevant for these students, and how have you done from your book?
I'm thank you for the opportunity to talk about that. And I'll just quickly say, if my publisher is listening, I would love the opportunity to do a second edition because I learned much more about Jainism since I wrote that book than I knew did it. So it's been 12 years and I've had a lot more interaction with the community and so on. But in the current book, what I do at the beginning, I really talk about what I'm intending to do with the book. And the idea is to reach people who really don't know anything about the tradition. And I have some reflections in there just drawn from my experience of teaching college students in the U.S. that they found the Jain tradition was the most difficult one for them to relate to in many ways. Because the Jain tradition takes certain core ideas that you find in all the Dharma traditions, like karma, for example, and it takes them to their, I guess you could say their logical end, or if you were being critical, you could say to their extreme. Hmm. I suppose the dramatic case would be the Salekana or Santara practice. Yes. Very few Jains actually do, but they're the idea that slowly not, you know, ingesting food and starving to death, giving up the body, that this could be the noblest and the highest and most spiritual thing you could do. Hmm. From students, mostly from a Christian background, they have a hard time wrapping their heads around that.
Right.
Why? You know? And, you know, but of course their tradition is based on the idea that Jesus gave his life for people. So why not give our life for all life forms, right? About the insects, the microbes, and so on. And what I find some of the students, in fact, they came away admiring the tradition greatly, but not relating to it. They could see themselves, you know, maybe being Hindu, right? They could identify, you know, they enjoyed the imagery of the deities and festivals. They could see themselves easily being Buddhist. You know, they like meditation. Mm-hmm. And being Jain, there's like, no, it's too hard, right?
This was their ridiculous.
I wanted to present it in a way that could address and overcome some of that, what I might call resistance on the part of the students. And I wanted to be sure it wasn't something in the way I was presenting it that was causing the problem. And so what I did in the book is I tried to emphasize, I thought, maybe a little more than I saw, for example, in Professor Jaini's book, the experience of everyday Jain householders, lay people who are not monks, right? Mm-hmm. They're not putting the ground in front of them, and as they're not wearing the mupati all the time. They're, they're not, you know, doing santara. They are living the lives of really very similar to what, say, Vaishnav Hindus in Gujarat would, same diet and everything. Mm-hmm. So, and even the cover of the book, you know, it's a conventional way of doing a book on Jainism. You have a picture of a monk or of a picture of a murti of one of the jinnas, and everything's very serene. You know, you think of Mount Abu, right?
Yeah.
White marble, everything is serene. So I have this crazy picture of people at the Abhisheka of Bahubali getting just soaked with this, sindhur and
red color. Yep. Yes.
Milk and water, and it's all just kind of raining down on them, and they're celebrating and they're happy. It's this very joyful thing. So I wanted to say, you know, the Jain tradition is as joyful and life affirming, rich for Jain.
Exuberance. Yeah.
It's joyful. It's bhakti going on, so that they don't come away. The readers don't come away with the idea that it's only austerity and fasting. You know, you'll get these very exaggerated books. That, well, okay, there was a book over a century ago by a woman named Margaret Stevenson, and Paul Dunn mentions it in the book. Yeah, it's called The Heart of Jainism. And as Paul Dunn says, its basic thesis is that Jainism has no heart. It is, you know, fasting. And you know, that's so wrong, right? That's contrary to any time in the community. It's the opposite of what you find. Mm-hmm. And so I want a sense of the joy. I could have called the book The Joy of Jainism. Maybe the it's because you know you're trying to the Jain teaching, and you see this in Vedanta too, right? The soul, the jiva, is pure bliss, right? Satyadatta in Vedanta tradition, they say ananta sukha, right? Infinite bliss is the soul in Jainism.
Satyadanam,
exactly. It's not gloomy and
right.
Pessimistic.
So, So I guess on Salekhana or Santara, how have they responded? I mean, how did you, if you take a, you know, more specific example of that, how exactly have you, you know, tried to overcome their resistance, and how do you explain that? Why Santara, why Salekhana?
Yeah, I finally found a story that actually was very helpful in that regard.
Okay.
It's the story of the great Digambar sage Samantabhadra.
Uh-huh.
And author of a very important text, Aptamimansa, really a major thinker in developing Syadvada, but that's how I knew him originally. But he also undertook Salekhana. And there's a story about him. I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but according to the story, an important thing about Salekhana, this sort of self-starvation, you have to do it with the permission of your guru. You don't just kind of decide, right? There's a book on this called Salekhana is Not Suicide, and it explains, you know, this isn't something you do out of despair or despondency. It's Again, this very joyful, detached setting aside of the body. So according to the story, Samantabhadra contracted leprosy. So he had this terrible disease. So he decided to undertake Salekhana. So he asked his guru, and his guru said, no, you're attached to your body. You want to do this because you want to become free from the pain of the body. So, but you know, the pain comes from your karma. And if you do that, you're going to be born in another body and you're going to keep having the same pain. So he go spend some time, spend a year, according to the version that I read, he's spend a year meditating and reflecting. And so he did. And he came back and his master, his guru said, so do you still want to undertake Salekhana? And according to the story, Samantabhadra says, well, I've been meditating a lot and I realize, you know, that this jiva, the soul, is not the body. The body's like the thing, you know, you put it on, it comes and goes. He said, I leave it up to you. I am attached. I'm unconcerned whether I do Salekhana or not. It's in your hands. And then his master says, now you're ready to do Salekhana.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
You can see the detachment and you can have detached your soul from your body. Now you're ready. All right. Yeah. Okay.
It comes from this very serene place. And when the students read that story, they still, it still, I think, is probably very alien to them, but it makes more sense than just, you know, oh, you starve yourself and is. Yeah, they're getting really more a richer understanding.
It is definitely not suicide. Yeah, so at least that must be clear that it's not suicide.
Like, suicide's really regarded as a very you know, pop karma, right? It's a very bad karma. It's a very bad thing to do in all the Dharma traditions. And there's this very serene letting go of the body, and there's a tradition of doing that in all the traditions. And of course, there's the famous story of Buddhist monks in Vietnam who immolated themselves while they were in meditation. But they weren't feeling any pain. They were in a very serene state, but they did this out of compassion to draw attention to the world to what was happening in their country. And that is not suicide in the convention. If suicide means taking one's own life because of some very deep emotional turmoil, that's
defeatist. Yeah, right. So it's not suicide. Yeah. It's also not euthanasia, right? From the example that you shared. Yes, yeah.
Go ahead, please. Yeah. Right.
So other question I have faced when I have tried teaching Jainism to students in Texas, how do you how do you relate the condition of asceticism and the fact that certain eligibilities are required before you can achieve moksha? How have you dealt with in your teaching or in your book? You know, for example, monks and nuns issues or gender issues. Would you like to share a little bit more on that?
Right. I've talked about those in a very frank way. The Shvetambara and Digambara traditions have different views about this. And another great book by Padmanabh Jaini is Gender and Self.
Yes.
And he talks about the fact that according to the Digambara interpretation of Jainism, that there are five core practices that are required of everyone for moksha. Right. And one of them, aparigraha, so non-attachment, non-ownership. And the Digambaras take that very literally to mean that even clothing, right, something so basic as clothing, the fact that we wear clothing is a sign of our attachment to the body. And even that has to go. So Digambar means clad, and the main ascetics don't wear anything. No. And they say that's a prerequisite for... Now, women cannot undertake that practice. Mm-hmm. According to the teaching, it's believed that it would cause a scandal in society, and there would be, you know, all kinds of bad things that is believed that could come from that.
Right.
So the implication is that in the Digambara interpretation, you have to be reborn. Mm-hmm. Several things: reborn as a male, mm-hmm. then become a Jain, become a Digambara Jain, mm-hmm. become a Digambara Jain ascetic, and practice this complete aparigraha,
yes.
and only then can you get moksha. And I mean, the student's reaction to that, and I think many of us kind of instinctively think, well, that's not fair, right? I mean, you know, we know women who are very spiritually evolved. There were great women teachers, mm-hmm. including in the Digambara tradition of Jainism. Right? There's mm-hmm. this wonderful teacher I think you and I have both met.
Gyanmati Mata, yes. He's somewhere in Delhi right now. Yes.
One of the most inspirational people I've ever met. Mm-hmm. But according to her own tradition, she's going to have to be reborn as a male in order to get liberation. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Shvetambara interpretation says, well, you know, it's the attitude of aparigraha that matters. You know, this kind of becoming overly preoccupied with things like clothing is itself a type of attachment. You know, there are fierce debates between the yes. two about this. In fact, they even say the 19th Tirthankara Malinath is female.
Yes. Shvetambara says.
And that's right. And the Shvetambaras also say that Queen Trishula, that is the mother of Mahavira, attained moksha. Right. Mm. So. That's in the agamas, which the Digambaras don't accept.
They don't accept. Yeah.
So there's this debate. Yeah. I would say there's a very delicate balance as a teacher that you want to maintain when you're presenting this material. On the one hand, everyone's of course free to have their own opinion, and I mean my own sympathies are, I think, much more on the Shvetambara side in this issue. Mm. But that makes me even more careful to try to present the Digambara view in as sympathetic a light as possible. Mm-hmm. And there's something important to note. Mm-hmm. It's not the case that, well, now you're a woman, you can't be liberated, but maybe in your next life you'll be a male. And you, according to Jain teaching, we have already passed the period of cosmic mm-hmm. history. Anybody in this world can get liberation. Mm-hmm. So we're all going to have to get reborn. Right?
Exactly.
So in some future, you know, yuga,
right.
you know, maybe, you know, we all get reborn as male Digambaras and, you know, do the practice. But
we're all ineligible.
Yes, we're all ineligible. We're so all, in that sense, then it's not as restrictive as it looks, because it's not that the Digambaras are all getting moksha, you know, the Gummer males are just like all getting moksha right and left. You know, it hasn't happened in thousands of years, according to much like Theravada Buddhism, there hasn't been an arhat for thousands of years, according to the Theravada teaching. So I always try to give that side so that people don't leave class thinking, well, the Gummer Jains are sexist. I mean, that's the temptation, and you don't want them to play with that.
Yeah. Right. And I guess let's go to the next point. Next question, if I may ask, is, you know, sometimes I used to face this question that does Jains are discouraged from doing charity? Is it okay to help do a, you know, charity in a traditional sense? Is it okay to do from Jain perspective or not? Would you like to, you know, share a little bit more how you have dealt that issue in your book and with your students also?
Because the question comes up because, you know, all of our sufferings are due to our karma.
Right.
And I've actually had to do a lot of research myself to kind of fully understand the Jain view on this, because there's a lot of Jain charity that goes on. Right? Early animal hospitals in the world, the Panjabals, were made by the Jains.
Right.
So clearly there's a view that you can do good for others.
Right.
What I find is sort of the limit of that in Jainism is, you used this word earlier when we were talking about Selekana, euthanasia.
Yeah.
That is a line that cannot be crossed. That if an animal or a human being is suffering a lot physically, it is not an acceptable expression of compassion to end their life. And the reason for this is actually very logical if you think about Jainism, because we are all suffering because of our karma.
Right.
Now, if you end someone's life thinking, I'm ending their suffering, well, you don't know that their pop karma, their bad karma, has been exhausted. they're probably going to get reborn and suffer again.
Yeah.
Now, if someone says, well, then why is it okay to give medicine? Why is it okay to give a glass of water, right? Why is it okay to do other kinds? Well, you're not ending their life, right? You're not taking away their opportunity. And in fact, within their lifetime, you could say that the fact that they have met you is also part of the karma, right? So there's bad karma, but there's also good karma. There's punya karma. So they've met you. You can do a good deed and, you know, you feed animals, care for human beings who are sick and poor. But ending the life of a living being is, for any reason, isn't acceptable.
Right. Exactly.
I sometimes use this expression. I said, if Jains believed in a creator God, they would say you're playing God, right? By taking.
Right.
That's not a Jain view. So, but I did once hear a Jain use that expression, and they're playing God. You know, it's like the idea that.
You reminded me of a famous controversy that Mahatma Gandhi had with traditional Jains in Ahmedabad, right? Maybe you also know that, right? That a cow was suffering, and Gandhi wanted to kill that cow. Euthanasia for that cow. And Jain said, no, you cannot play God. Let the cow fulfill its own, you know, karma path. Let it fulfill, let it suffer whatever suffering, because we don't want to force that cow to for another birth to get rid of his or her pap, you know, past pap karma or whatever. So even Gandhi Jain disagreed even with Gandhi. That was very reported in newspapers.
Yeah. There's a wonderful film on Jainism. In fact, it's about Ahmedabad and focuses on it's called The Frontiers of Peace.
Yes.
Jainism. And I've cited it in my book and I use it in my classes all the time. And they talk about that incident. And this shocks the students because a couple of weeks before, they've watched scenes from the movie Gandhi and they've learned about Gandhi. And so they're all Gandhi, nonviolence. And they realize even point of view, even Gandhi wasn't quite.
Even Gandhi was not quite nonviolent from Zen perspective. Yes. Oh, that is giving me another question to continue our conversation. So, what about the intellectual violence or intellectual nonviolence? Professor Coate wrote a very interesting paper, Intellectual Nonviolence, that can be correlated with Syadvad. And then you dealt with your book, I think, in the final chapter, that Jains are pretty close to intellectual nonviolence based on Syadvad and Anikandwa. What is your view now that it has been more than a decade that you wrote your book, and maybe you can...
Right. Well, and in fact, one of the things that attracted me to studying Syadvad was precisely because that looks like intellectual ahimsa, right? If you interpret it a certain... What John Coate argued, and Paul Dundas makes this point as well, and then Professor Jaini made it to me in person when I met him once. By the way, I want you to really understand traditionally, many Jain philosophers actually use Advaita to show that, look, the Jain view is all-encompassing. These other views are partial, right? So it's really very much like a glass half water, a glass of water half full or half empty argument. Like, if you want to look at it positively, you could say, look, the Jain philosophy is saying that there's truth in all traditions. Mm-hmm. But then you can switch it and say, yeah, but the Jain philosophy is also saying that all traditions have only part of the truth. Whereas you can encompass many perspectives. Mm-hmm. And the way I approach that in my book, and it's still pretty close to what I say today, is that from a historical perspective, Professor Coate is absolutely right. I mean, if you look at the text, that's what they say. Though there are a couple of interesting exceptions. Hari Bhadrasuri, very important thinker, Dr. Chappell, Chris Chappell, has done a really good translation of his Yoga Drishti Samuchaya, where, you know, his collection of views on yoga. And he's really affirming what he sees as positive in all of these perspectives. There's a couple of critical things to say about Tantra, but otherwise, Haribhadra is very, you know, all-encompassing in his view.
Yes.
And then more recently, just a few centuries ago, Yashovijaya, also
very open, very well respecting to everybody, right? All are true, all are good. Yes,
all are good. He quotes from the Gita, you know, and things like that. He's quite happy to bring in things from. He studied Navya-Nyaya in Banaras and is open to many philosophies.
Right.
The predominant thread has been, the Buddhists have peace of the truth, and Sankhya has peace of the truth, and, you know, Nyaya has peace of the truth, but the Jain Darshan has the whole truth. So they're right about that historically, but the thing is about Anikantavada, Syadvada, these are philosophical concepts.
Mm-hmm.
So if you've understood the concept, you can apply it any way you wish, as long as you can defend and show that it's consistent. and logical. And also, a long-term project I have is to go into this in more depth. Mm-hmm. Going back to the Dagmar tradition, you know, we were giving the Digambaras maybe a hard time earlier about the women's issue, but mm-hmm. The really great Digambar Acharya or teacher, Akumkunda, mm-hmm. Has his own model of the doctrine of perspectives. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the Nischayanaya, that is mm-hmm. the ultimate, highest or final perspective. Mm-hmm. And for him, that's not actually Jainism. Mm-hmm. It's something beyond words, beyond concepts that one has to experience. It's the nature of the soul itself. He calls it samasara, is the nature of the soul. The essence of the soul is the ultimate perspective. Mm-hmm. And so anything that you put into words is going to be in the relative. Mm-hmm. He uses the term vyavaharanai. This is the Jain version of the two truths doctrine that some might know is also used by Shankaracharya and by Nagarjuna. Maybe the Jains came upon it first, though that's debatable. That's all these things about it is debatable. But there's a Jain version of it. And I think Kundalini's perspective definitely creates a space for what we today call pluralism. So there's an ultimate truth that's beyond words, but when we're in the realm of thoughts and ideas, you know, we can connect them in this way, you know, using Sadvat and so on. And a nice thing about this whole line of questioning is it shows there is diversity in the Jain tradition too.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And not every thinker is saying exactly the same thing.
Right. So I guess, so can we say that Jain, even with this diversity of views, Jain philosophy in general is tending more towards intellectual nonviolence?
Today that seems to be the dominant view. I mean, when I speak with people in the Jain community, I mean, that's the understanding, mm-hmm. right? And three, I call them the three A's, right? Mm-hmm. Ahimsa, anekantvad, and aparigraha. That constitute a kind of holistic approach to life that is rooted in not harming others and not, you know, more than we need, and in respecting the views of others, not engaging
in
controversy, and so on. So I think that the intellectual ahimsa idea has become the dominant view in the Jain.
Especially as the diaspora Jains living in Americas or in Europe, they are really promoting that intellectual nonviolence is the frontal phrase of Jainism globally.
It is
what they like to project, at least here.
It is.
We can say that.
And but even in India, you know, like the recent passed away, Acharya Mahapragya. His writing on Sadvada really influenced my thinking a lot when I was writing my dissertation. He taught that as well. But yes, this is kind of, like you say, the public face of the Jain community. On the end, you know, sort of more critical scholars would point out that you'll also have Jains who say Jainism is the highest religion, it's the universal religion, it's the supreme religion. Like, everyone says that about their religion.
We are the best. We are the best. Everybody says
that. Whatever we are, we're the best. And but I don't see the kind of aggressive proselytizing.
That's absolutely true. Yes. At least they will. I have not met any Hindu, Jain, or even for that matter, Hindu or Buddhist who will say that if you're not a Jain or Hindu or Buddhist, you're going to hell. That's not going to happen. They're not saying. Nobody's saying that.
And even if you did, you'd be reborn after that somewhere else. But if you went to hell, it wouldn't be because you weren't a Jain. It would be because you killed somebody or something.
You have to face your karma. You have to face your consequences. Right. I guess let's come to now another major topic that that I'm sure you have dealt with and I've dealt with in my teaching with the students here, undergraduate or graduate, is the issue of Gandhi and influence of Jainism on Gandhi. What is your view, or how have you dealt in your book connecting Gandhi with Jainism?
Yeah, I think Gandhi was heavily influenced by Jainism, and there's several pieces of evidence for this. And one is his own words, right? He says, in fact, he talks about anekantavad and syadvad specifically. He said, "I'm an anekantavadi, I'm a syadvadi." You know, he adopts that. He grew up in Gujarat, which is has a very heavy population. Before he went to England to study law, he took vows before a Jain monk to abstain from any impure practice while he was abroad. And the Jain monk was his mother's guru, though she was a Vaishnav Hindu. So he had this wonderful interplay of religions there. Yeah. And then, of course, we also know that Gandhi's own guru, his great exemplar in life, was Srimad Rajchandra, Raichand Bhai Mehta, and who was a Jain diamond merchant, but though a householder, mm-hmm. as far as everyone says, everything we have written about him, totally detached and really embodied and taught for Gandhi, you know, the core principles. And he really learned the Hindu from Rajchandra Mehta. So, and there's a whole, you know, Jain school of thought based on Srimad Rajchandra writings. So we have every reason to say that Gandhi was very heavily influenced by the Jain tradition. Though, to my knowledge, he never called himself a Jain. One of my favorite Gandhi quotes, and I delve into it in the book, is where he actually talks about Anekanthavad, because he had several newspapers, and one of them was called Young India, and he always wrote an editorial, and sometimes he would talk in terms of Advaita Vedanta and universal oneness, and then he would also talk about God in a very theistic way. Vaishnavas or Christians or Muslims could relate to. So someone wrote a letter to the editor and said, which is it? Do you believe in Advaita Vedanta or do you believe in, you know, theism and he's dualism? And he said, well, I'm an Anekanthavadi. I believe in both.
Perfect answer.
Yeah, exactly. So he really, and he did something that, I call it practical Anekanthavada, kind of like Swami Vivekananda's practical Vedanta. For him, it wasn't just a theoretical or philosophical concept, but it shaped how he interacted with people. So when he comments on what he means, he says, my Anekanthavada is not that of the philosophers. He said, it's practical. I have learned to see myself as others see me, and to be patient with those with whom I disagree, because I have to see them from their perspective. So for him, it was a very practical, again, a kind of intellectual ahimsa.
Right. I completely agree with that. All what you said. Yeah, he did get inspiration from Leo Tolstoy and John Ruskin and Bhagavad Gita, but Srimad Rajchandra's influence, I think, was one of the heaviest on him, although he never called himself Jain, but he corresponded for 6 years while he was in South Africa, and Srimad Rajchandra was in Gujarat, and they were writing letters to each other. Gandhi was asking questions, and he almost says that he's my guru, but not quite officially, but he's almost like my guru, and he's getting.
Yeah, I think a guru in a sort of very spiritual and meaningful sense, but not a kind of formal sense. Like, I don't think he gets kind of diksha or anything like that. And in fact, he wasn't in a position to, because he was a layperson, right? He wasn't a monk.
Yeah.
So, but a guru in a kind of,
in a very teacher and inspirator teacher in that sense.
Right.
And he apparently visited some of the places where Srimad Rajchandra was staying or living. And so, he definitely was very heavily influenced. But of course, he also called Bhagavad Gita as his mother, John Ruskin and Leo Tolstoy. And even S.D. Thoreau, I think he took ideas from all over the place.
He loved the Sermon on the Mount. He said that was
everything.
All the scriptures of the world disappeared and only the Sermon on the Mount was left. That would be enough. So.
Right. And then Gandhi's influence on Dr. King and Nelson Mandela. So can we say that this thread is running from Mahavir to Srimad Rajchandra to Gandhi to Dr. King and to Nelson Mandela, and so it sort of remains relevant, I think, Samas, right?
I think you can say that. Is there's another book I've recently written on Hinduism in America, which
is
complementary in many ways to your Dharma in America that is on the bookshelf there behind you. And I think one of the threads of, if we broaden it beyond Hinduism, just say, you know, Indian spiritual thought, philosophy, culture in America, there's definitely a Jain thread there. And it's what you're talking about, right? It's this sense of nonviolence, not just peace, but nonviolence, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a great book. It was one that I used a lot, cited a lot in my work on Hinduism in America by Paul Oliver. It's called Hinduism in the 1960s.
Oh.
And the counterculture and the whole, the hippie movement, the peace movement. And he mentions Jainism as an influence. And it's just like you said, via Gandhi, very quiet subterranean way. You have actually Jain finding its way into the life and speech work of Martin King, Nelson Mandela.
In very intangible ways, but still, yes.
Yeah.
things like
that. And that, you know, vegetarianism, of course, that's part of Hinduism as well, but it's so emphasized by the Jains, right? So these are all things that became more popular and important in starting in the 1960s in the US, and they have, you know, Jainism is part of that genealogy, I would say.
Great. I think we covered a lot of interesting topics. I think anything you would like to add that we that I didn't ask so far, anything you would like to add?
I guess one thing I know it's very dear to your heart. And I said a little bit about it in my book, but with Jainism and ecology and the environment.
Yes.
I think that's in your Dharma and Ecology book is there behind you too. This is along with Anekantavada, this is another big part. As you said, the sort of public face of Jainism, that this is a very ecologically conscious tradition. And there too, you know, scholars like John Court and Paul Dundas have pointed out, you know, in a critical vein, say, the ancient Jains weren't environmentalists in the modern sense. They were interested in moksha, right? They weren't interested in saving the earth. They were interested in getting away from it, right? But the effect of their practice and their impact on the environment or lack of impact on the environment is exactly what we need right now. And I wrote an article on this way like early in my career. It's called The Paradoxes of Radical Asceticism. And the paradox of Jain ascetic practice is that in the process of seeking to escape from the world and become free from the world, they have shown the way to save the world. That by not consuming more than one need, reducing our what we now call our carbon footprint, we're actually doing good. And so I think that that's another piece I'd want to mention in the Jain tradition.
Keeping really the carbon footprint low and not interfering with nature's its own course. Let the nature take its own course. Let the animals take their own course. Insects, do not touch, do not kill, do not harm, stay away. You follow your path, let them follow their paths, right?
And if I could, just one last thing. This is how I end the book, actually. I'm giving away the maybe that's spoiler alert, right? But I say this to my students in my classes, is most Westerners will not want to become Jain, right? This is the whole consumer lifestyle of the West, so at odds with this. But if everyone became just a little more Jain, it'd be a huge, giant environmental impact. You know, okay, you're not going to become a vegetarian. Be a vegetarian one day a week.
Little bit, little bit fasting, little bit vegetarianism, less meat consumption, a bit more conscious, less shirt, maybe one more year with your old car, one more year with your old furniture, right? Something like that. Yes. Wonderful. Thank you. Yes.
You know, don't turn the lights on if you're not in the room.
Because light also, electricity also is part of fire, and fire has soul. Fire-bodied beings have souls. So do not, you know, little less wastage of water, little less wastage of energy, little less wastage of earth and air and all of that. Yes. Good. And all Jains have to remember that also. You know, all Jains are not perfect beings. Everybody has to implement these great teachings.
This is what Professor Jaini wanted to make sure I understood. He attended a talk that I gave on Anekantavada, you know, how it could be used for intellectual hinsa and so on. And I mentioned it in my talk, but I think he was very concerned that I not romanticize Jain. Just want you to know that Jains are, and he said this as a Jain, he said, you know, we're as terrible as everyone else.
I appreciate. So we all have to implement a bit more of these ideas, these great teachings to save our precious world. Yes. Wonderful.
We all need better. Yeah.
Yes. Anything else you would like to add? Or I think we covered a lot of ground. And
thank you for inviting me.
Yes. And I welcome and invite everybody, whoever is listening or will listen, to, you know, get into, you know, wet your feet by Professor Long's book. And then you're ready for next venture into diving into Jainism. But his book is a great entry or great gateway to the world of Jainism in a very, very, you know, he's holding your hands and taking it to the world of Jains. And so that's the way I see his book, which is great help to understand Jainism better.
Very kind of you.
Thank you. Thank you. Long. We'll continue these kind of conversations. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice meeting.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you. Bye-bye.